Dependent origination and emptiness. Streams of dependently arising processes interacting, by Lee Brazington. Dedication. For those who seek to evolve rather than just pursue high quality samsara. Preface. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Kurus, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "It is wonderful, Venerable Sir. It is amazing, Venerable Sir. This dependent origination is so deep, and so deep in implications, yet to me it seems as clear can be." "Not so, Ananda, not so. This dependent origination is deep and deep in implications. It is because of not understanding and not penetrating this Dhamma, Ananda, that this generation has become like a tangled skein, like a knotted ball of thread, like matted reeds and rushes, and does not pass beyond the plane of misery, the bad destinations, the netherworld, samsara." That's from Digha Nikaya 15 and Samyutta Nikaya 12.60. So, Lee, I hear that you are writing a book on dependent origination. Aren't you in the same boat as Ananda? Actually, I think Ananda had a better boat. So in that case, why are you writing a book on dependent origination? Well, there seems to be a lot of misinformation and lots of missing information about dependent origination. So I thought I'd share what I've learned so far about the topic, along with some of the implications of dependent origination not found explicitly in the suttas. Some of what I write here could be accurate. Some of it could completely miss the mark. And what's written here is certainly very incomplete. But it's what I've seen so far by exploring the concepts of dependent origination. All credit to the Buddha for finding and showing the way, and to all those who have preserved that Dhamma for us today. Introduction. This Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. Majjhima Nikaya 26.19. This book is not a complete treatment of the topic of dependent origination. Such a task is actually impossible even for a fully awakened one. Dependent origination is unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. No amount of words can do it justice. It has to be experienced for oneself. Nevertheless, there are lots of words that can be said which can serve as fingers pointing at the moon. What I'll attempt to do here is lay out the various traditional understandings of dependent origination, and then the deep, more profound teachings found in the suttas of the Pali Canon. As well, I'll bring in ideas and insights from later Buddhist literature, and also those I've personally encountered while working with dependent origination. The book is divided into three parts. Part 1 provides background information that will be needed to understand what follows. Part 2 discusses the links of dependent origination, examining various interpretations and their implications. Part 3 dives into the general case of dependently arising phenomena and the deeper implication thereof. One of the most important things to keep in mind when exploring any of the Buddha's teachings is that he was a phenomenologist, not a metaphysicist. By phenomenologist, I'm not referring to the philosophy of Edmund Husserl. Rather, I am saying that the Buddha was only interested in the phenomena we experience and our responses to those experiences. By saying not a metaphysicist, I'm pointing out that the Buddha was not interested in explaining the fundamental nature of the world. However, the general principle of dependent origination, which we will get to eventually, does have metaphysical implications, even though they are only a side effect. Even though the Buddha wasn't teaching metaphysics per se, Buddhist metaphysics certainly exists. But Buddhist metaphysics is a later invention and will not be of any help in understanding dependent origination. Eschewing metaphysics is actually a difficult thing to do for most people when they are studying spiritual literature. We all want to know, what's really going on here? Well, the Buddha didn't answer that sort of question. In fact, he point-blank refused to answer the primary metaphysical questions of his time. Is the cosmos infinite or not? Is the cosmos eternal or not? Is the soul the same as the body or not? What happens to an awakened one after death? He very consistently stuck to teaching dukkha and the end of dukkha, by having people explore the phenomena they experience and their responses to those experiences. In this regard, consider the Chulamalunkya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 63, which presents a simile about a man struck by a poisoned arrow who would not allow the arrow to be removed until he learned everything about the how and why of being struck by that arrow. That man dies before learning all the details because the arrow was not removed. Metaphysical questions are an equally useless distraction from the actual goal of ending dukkha. The scholarship supporting the phenomenological approach will emerge as we explore dependent origination from the perspective of the suttas of the Pali Canon. As we delve into dependent origination, you should keep this non-metaphysical, phenomenological outlook firmly in mind. Part 1. Background. Dependent origination is the most important teaching that the Buddha uses to explain what dukkha arises dependent upon and to provide a strategy for ending dukkha. Dependent origination is often presented as linked lists of dependencies, frequently numbering 12 items. But it is far more than just the 12-item linked list. The implications of the general case of something arising dependent upon something else are quite profound and lead to some of the deepest of all the Buddhist teachings. The next four chapters provide background information needed to begin to understand what the Buddha was teaching with dependent origination. These chapters go from more general to more specific. Dukkha is a bummer. Both formerly and now, what I teach is dukkha and the end of dukkha. Majjhima Nikaya 22.38, Samyutta Nikaya 22.86. As a starting point for exploring dependent origination, we need to keep in mind the Buddha's own statement about exactly what he was teaching. He said on several occasions that he taught dukkha and the end of dukkha. Hopefully this book will show how an understanding of dependent origination leads to gaining the insights necessary for ending dukkha. The extremely important Pali word dukkha gets translated using a number of different English words, suffering, stress, unsatisfactoriness, but none of these words really captures what the Buddha was saying when he used the word dukkha. It does mean suffering and stress and unsatisfactoriness, but it includes all the minor annoyances of life as well. It's basically getting what one does not want and not getting what one does want. It covers all those little niggling feelings that life is not perfect. In a number of discourses, the Buddha says, "Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, illness is dukkha, death is dukkha, union with what is displeasing is dukkha, separation from what is pleasing is dukkha, not to get what one wants is dukkha. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are dukkha." Digha Nikaya 22, Samyutta Nikaya 56.11. What if we plug in the usual English words and see what we get? But rather than using that whole long sentence above, let's start with, having the flu is dukkha. Losing your sunglasses is dukkha. So, first, suffering. Having the flu is suffering. Yeah, okay. Losing your sunglasses is suffering. Not really, you wimp. Suffering seems too strong in some cases, so let's try stress. Having the flu is stress. Yeah, but I want to change stress to stressful. Losing your sunglasses is stress. Once more, stressful would work better. So, having the flu is stressful. Yeah, okay. Losing your sunglasses is stressful. If losing sunglasses is stressful, you need a vacation for sure. Again, stress seems too strong in some cases, and changing stress to stressful changes a noun to an adjective. We lose something thereby. What about unsatisfactoriness? Having the flu is unsatisfactoriness. Too weak, and I want to change unsatisfactoriness to unsatisfactory. Losing your sunglasses is unsatisfactoriness. Again, unsatisfactory would work better. So, having the flu is unsatisfactory. That's a weird way to speak for sure. Losing your sunglasses is unsatisfactory. It works, but it's weird, and again we are going from a noun to an adjective. Maybe instead of using the usual English words, what if we try working from the literal meaning of dukkha, dirty hole? The hole originally referred to the axle hole in a cart wheel. In order for the wheel to turn smoothly, the hole needs greasing. But the grease can also cause dirt and pebbles to collect in the hole, thus giving an unsatisfactory ride. So a dirty hole produces unpleasantness. Let's try the literal meaning of dukkha. Having the flu is a dirty hole. Losing your sunglasses is a dirty hole. We need to insert the article A, since Pali has no articles, but this is actually much less meaningful than anything above. Is there any English phrase that is close to dirty hole and means things are not quite right? How about bad space? Having the flu is a bad space. Losing your sunglasses is a bad space. I'd want to fix these up as, having the flu put me in a bad space. Losing your sunglasses puts you in a bad space. This is a little better, but we've strayed rather far from the simple, having the flu is dukkha. What other English phrases mean something like, put me in a bad space? What about bummed me out, or even better, the shortened bummer? Having the flu is a bummer. Losing your sunglasses is a bummer. Again, we've needed to introduce the article A, but this is much more promising. Let's try it in the original quote. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is a bummer. Aging is a bummer. Illness is a bummer. Death is a bummer. Grief, lamentation, bodily pain, mental pain, and despair are bummers. Having to associate with what is displeasing is a bummer. Separation from what is pleasing is a bummer. Not getting what one wants, that too is a bummer. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are all bummers. The downsides seem to be only the need for A and the need at times to make bummer plural. But this better captures the range of dukkha than suffering or stress or unsatisfactoriness, and it doesn't generate weird constructs either. It keeps the word as a noun and a noun with an embedded verb sense, since a bummer bums you out. Plus, very importantly, it captures the fact that the Buddha wasn't teaching that dukkha resides in the object but in your mind. See, for example, the Sutta on the Two Arrows at Samyutta Nikaya 36.6. If aging and death are dukkha, the end of dukkha doesn't imply the end of aging or death. The end of dukkha implies not getting all bummed out when these things occur. This gives a much clearer picture that the end of dukkha doesn't come from changing the external world, but by changing one's reaction to the external world. Bummer! I lost my sunglasses at the beach. Well, it's only sunglasses. Don't get all bummed out about it. Of course, we should check this more carefully by plugging bummer into a few more of the Buddha's teachings. How about the Four Noble Truths? Dukkha. Bummers happen. The origin of dukkha. Bummers arise dependent on craving. The cessation of dukkha. With the cessation of craving comes the cessation of bummers. The path of practice that leads to the cessation of dukkha. The Noble Eightfold Path leads to the cessation of bummers. That works. Let's try another. I teach only dukkha and the end of dukkha. I teach only bummers and the end of bummers. And from Samyutta Nikaya 12.15, one has no uncertainty or doubt that when there is arising, only dukkha is arising, and that when there is passing away, only dukkha is passing away. One has no uncertainty or doubt that when there is arising, only bummers are arising, and that when there is passing away, only bummers are passing away. Not quite as smooth, but it still works. How about a more modern phrase? May you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, which actually is, may you be free from dukkha and the causes of dukkha. And that converts to, may you be free from bummers and the causes of bummers. Yep, that's what we're after. Maybe bummer is too flippant for such a serious subject. It's doubtful it will make it into the academic world, and we're highly unlikely to find translations using bummer rather than suffering or stress, but maybe thinking about dukkha from a hippie slang perspective will help you understand more deeply what exactly the Buddha was teaching. I will continue to use dukkha rather than bummer or any other translation of this very important word. Although bummer comes closer to capturing what dukkha means than any other English word, in my opinion, even bummer does not encompass all the subtleties of the meaning of dukkha. The key thing is that dukkha does not reside out there. It resides in your response to the inevitable suffering, stress, and bummers of life. The Buddha's teaching of dependent origination is pointing to a way of experiencing the world such that your responses to the stresses of life don't generate negative mental states. The Noble Quest. This generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this important thing, namely, this-that conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see these important things, namely the stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Majjhima Nikaya 26.19. Thus have I heard. 2,500 years ago in northern India there lived a young man of the Gautama clan. We don't really know his first name. He is usually referred to as Siddhartha Gautama, but that's clearly a much later tradition. He was apparently the son of the elected leader of the Sakyans. In other words, he came from a well-to-do family. At the age of 29, he left his homeland at the foot of the Himalayas and headed south to the Ganges River Valley to seek his spiritual fortune. The Ganges River Valley at that time was crawling with spiritual seekers. The economy in India, which was agriculture-based, had reached a level of sophistication such that it could support people who weren't directly engaged in producing food. This had resulted in a large number of full-time spiritual seekers who gained their livelihood by going on alms rounds. This also led to the rise of standing armies. You win some, you lose some. Master Gautama headed east and south to the land of the Kalamas. There he studied with a teacher named Alara Kalama. He learned Alara's doctrine and his meditation practice, which culminated in what we know as the seventh jhana, the realm of no-thingness. In fact, Master Gautama was so skilled at the practices and understood the doctrine of Alara Kalama so well that eventually Alara said to him, "Come, we will lead this order together." But Master Gautama had left home because he was seeking an end to dukkha. However, all he'd learned was the seventh jhana. Dukkha was still there upon returning to normal consciousness from the realm of no-thingness. So he left. He continued on south to the kingdom of Magadha, where he sought out another teacher, Udaka Ramaputta, Udaka the son of Rama. He learned Rama's doctrine and his practice, which culminated in what we know as the eighth jhana, the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. At that point, Udaka offered him sole leadership of that group, but once again, Master Gautama had not learned what to do about dukkha, so again he left. He spent the next several years practicing austerities. He practiced things like holding his breath for as long as he could. What he discovered was that if you hold your breath for a long time, over and over again, it generates terrible headaches. He practiced eating one grain of rice a day. From that, he discovered that if you eat one grain of rice a day, you get really skinny and weak. In fact, eventually Master Gautama became so weak that he had a tendency to fall over. He realized some 6 years after he'd left his home that he was in such an emaciated state that he was in no condition to do any sort of spiritual practice. All of his austere striving had not brought him any closer to understanding what to do about dukkha. He began thinking about what he could do instead of these austerities. He remembered an incident from his childhood when he was sitting under a rose apple tree and his father was working, plowing, it is usually assumed. While young Master Gautama sat there, he fell into the first jhana. Reflecting back some quarter century later on that experience of the first jhana, he thought, "Why am I afraid of that pleasure? It has nothing to do with sensuality. Could these jhanas be the way to awakening?" Reflecting even further, he decided these jhanas are the way to awakening. But being so weak, he realized that in order to resume jhana practice, he was going to have to regain his strength, so he began eating solid food. Now at that time, there were 5 other ascetics practicing with Master Gautama, and when they saw he was eating solid food, they thought he had resorted to a life of luxury, and they left in disgust. But Master Gautama had not resorted to a life of luxury. He hadn't given up the spiritual path. He was just seeking something other than the dead ends he had so far explored. The suttas don't say how long it took him to regain his strength. It probably would have taken some months. During that time, he found a good place under a fig tree near the Niranjara River to live and practice. Some of the suttas tell us that one evening, as the sun was setting, he sat down to meditate and entered the jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then, well, the suttas give various accounts of what happened that night. Maybe all of what the various accounts say happened, maybe only some of them happened. But for sure, when the sun rose the next morning, Master Gautama was a changed person. He was awake. He was the Buddha. It is said that he spent the next 7 weeks hanging out in the vicinity of what we now call the Bodhi tree. He apparently spent the first week just enjoying the bliss of awakening. He eventually began contemplating whether he could teach what he had discovered to anyone else. At first, his mind was disinclined to teach. What he had learned was quite subtle. It went against the stream. It went against the culture of people who were pursuing pleasure and enjoying their acquisitions. In Majjhima Nikaya 26.19, we find the Buddha recounting his musing at that time. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this important thing, namely this-that conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see these important things, namely the stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. The two sentences about important things are very significant if we really want to understand what the Buddha was teaching. This sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26, is regarded by many scholars as being likely the most authentic story of the Buddha's awakening that can be found in the Pali Canon. The first important thing mentioned in verse 19 is idapacayata paticca samuppado, which is a compound consisting of idapacayata and paticca samuppada. The first word is defined in the Pali English Dictionary as having its foundation in this, causally connected by way of cause. More colloquially, we can say this arises because of that, or to shorten it further, this-that conditionality. Paticca samuppada is the word we translate as dependent origination or dependent arising. Sometimes you find it translated as dependent co-origination or dependent co-arising, with the internal sam becoming the co. But some scholars, like Rice Davids in the Pali English Dictionary, imply that the sam simply converts upada, coming into existence, appearance, or birth, into samuppada, origin, arising, genesis, coming to be, and production. And so the co is not actually in the Pali. As we'll see as we get deeper into the exploration of paticca samuppada, it is really just splitting hairs and not actually of any real importance whether the ko is there or not in English. My main reason for not using the ko is that I hear people talking about codependent origination or codependent arising, which is definitely not something the Buddha ever spoke about. I will use dependent origination to refer to the doctrine, teaching, and dependent arising to refer to the phenomenon or experience itself. This important thing, meaning the this-that conditionality or dependent origination, is the heart of the Buddha's teaching. At Majjhima Nikaya 28.28, Sariputta quotes the Buddha as having said, "One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination." Dependent origination is the richest vein to mine in the whole of the teachings. As the Buddha said to Ananda in the opening of Digha Nikaya 15, it's because of not understanding dependent origination that people have gotten themselves into this tangled ball of woe. This book is an exploration of just what the Buddha meant and was trying to teach using this important concept. This important thing, this-that conditionality or dependent origination, also appears to be the Buddha's best attempt to describe what happened the night of awakening. As we will see in a few chapters, what makes the most sense is found in the suttas Samyutta 12.65 and Udana 1.1 to 1.3. It indicates that the discovery of this-that conditionality, dependent origination, is what the Buddha discovered that night of his awakening. There is a second sentence at Majjhima Nikaya 26.19 on important things that are difficult to understand. namely the stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Our exploration of dependent origination will also be an exploration of these difficult yet important things. Obviously, the Buddha did decide to teach. He thought maybe those who had little dust in their eyes would understand what he had come to understand. And when those five ascetic friends, his first disciples, understood what he was teaching, he knew there were indeed people with little dust in their eyes. Necessary conditions. Dukkha arises dependent on craving. Samyutta Nikaya 56.11. To start getting a handle on dependent origination, it's necessary to understand that dependent origination is not about causes, but about necessary conditions. Understanding the idea of necessary condition is extremely important for understanding dependent origination. A necessary condition for the light in your room to be on is that the light switch be on. However, the light switch is not a sufficient condition. You also need the electrical power plant to be producing electricity, and you need all the wires from the power plant to the light in your room to be intact, as well as having a working light bulb. The light switch being on, the electric plant producing electricity, and the wires being intact are all necessary conditions for the light bulb to function. Furthermore, none of these are sufficient conditions, nor are any of them the actual cause of the light shining. The light actually shines because of excited electrons inside the light bulb emitting photons. The power of discovering necessary conditions comes from the fact that you don't need to understand the cause of something in order to turn it off or to prevent it from arising. All you need is a necessary condition you can manipulate. If something is happening and you want it to stop, find a necessary condition for that something and turn off that necessary condition, the something ceases. If you want to turn off the light in your room, you don't have to blow up the power plant. You don't have to cut the wires to your house. You don't even need to know what causes the light to shine. You can turn off the light just by turning off the light switch. It's an easily manipulable necessary condition for the light. If you want to prevent the light from coming back on, just prevent the light switch from being turned on. Dependent origination is a teaching about necessary conditions. Remember, the Buddha is only teaching dukkha and the end of dukkha. The method he uses to bring dukkha to an end is to identify necessary conditions for the arising of dukkha and then find some necessary condition he can manipulate to turn off the dukkha. This is what the teaching of the Four Noble Truths is all about. Number one, dukkha is the problem. Number two, dukkha arises dependent on the necessary condition of craving. Number three, with the ceasing of the necessary condition of craving, dukkha ceases. Number four, there is a path of practice that can be learned in order to cease craving and thereby cease generating dukkha. The Four Noble Truths are a summary of dependent origination in that they highlight some of the most important dependencies, particularly the one between craving and dukkha. My teacher, Ayakema, referred to the Four Noble Truths as dependent origination in telegram style. Today, I guess we would say in Twitter style. The major difficulty with this is that turning off craving is a lot harder than turning off a light switch. This is why, although an understanding of the Four Noble Truths is a great help on the path to freedom, it is not sufficient. A deeper teaching is needed to further help one fully accomplish turning off craving, and that teaching is this teaching of dependent origination. But it is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. An intellectual understanding of dependent origination is a good start, but is not sufficient. It must not only be understood, but it also must be experienced. But in order to experience this dependent origination deeply enough for it to be transformative, it does need to be understood first. So what do the 12 links of dependent origination really mean? What's the bigger picture here? How shall we interpret this? This is what we will look at in the next several chapters. The key. From what is endearing, there have arisen quarrels and disputes. From the Sutta Nipata 4.11. Frequently, when dependent origination is taught, it is discussed in terms of the 12 links of dependent origination. Each link is said to arise dependent upon the previous link. Dependent upon ignorance, sankhara arise. Dependent upon sankhara, consciousness arises. Dependent upon consciousness, name and form arise. Dependent upon name and form, six senses arise. Dependent upon six senses, contact arises. Dependent upon contact, vedana arises. Dependent upon vedana, craving arises. Dependent upon craving, clinging arises. Dependent upon clinging, becoming arises. Dependent upon becoming, birth arises. Dependent upon birth, aging and death arise. But what this 12-link model is attempting to teach is certainly not obvious and is difficult to grasp. Caroline Rhys Davids, one of the early Pali scholars, refers to it as a mysterious old rune. If you start trying to make sense of the 12 links, it's a difficult proposition. The next to the last thing that happens is you get born? That seems kind of weird. Everyone else points out that you get born first. Here you're getting born just before you die? What's that all about? That's not the only strange thing here. Once you begin to get a good understanding of what each link is actually referring to, even more strange things can start cropping up. Of course, the two Pali words sankhara and vedana need to be understood before anyone can begin to understand the 12 links. Sankhara is literally making together and refers in its most general sense to anything that is constructed, fabricated, concocted. So all the things of the material world are sankharas, but so are your thoughts, emotions, ideas, intentions, and memories. Sankhara gets translated using a large variety of English words in different contexts. But the Buddha was using only a single word in all those contexts. Hence, Tanisara Bhikkhu's fabrication and Santikaro's concoction are the most suitable translations. Vedana are your initial mental response to sensory inputs, and there are only three possibilities: pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. They are instinctual, automatic responses built into the old brain by evolution for survival purposes. They arise in your consciousness without any conscious intention or directing on your part. There is not really a good English word for translating vedana, although valence comes quite close. So I will always leave it untranslated. It definitely never means emotions, even though it is often translated as feelings. Rather than jumping right in with the 12 links, which is the most complex recension and most likely the latest development in the doctrine of dependent origination, I'm going to start at the beginning. But wait, where is the beginning? The Buddha's discourses were preserved as an oral tradition for approximately 3.5 centuries after his death. Eventually, they were written down in Sri Lanka in the 1st century BCE. It's possible for current scholars to look at the Pali that's used and be able to tell what is early Pali and what is later Pali. You have no trouble telling the difference between 18th century English and 21st century English, right? This is what the scholars are doing, as well as looking at the complexity of the doctrines presented and possible timelines for any biographical information. In doing so, they pretty much agree that a collection known as Book 4 of the Sutta Nipata contains some of the earliest material. The Sutta Nipata itself is a collection of 71 suttas in the Khuddaka Nikaya, the volume of miscellaneous discourses. The 11th discourse in Book 4 of the Sutta Nipata is entitled Kalaha Vivada Sutta, which we can translate as the Discourse on Quarrels and Disputes. It appears to be the earliest teaching on dependent origination that we have preserved in the Pali Canon. The sutta is a series of questions and answers. The initial question is, from where do quarrels and disputes arise? The answer, from what is endearing, there have arisen quarrels and disputes. In other words, quarrels and disputes arise dependent upon what is felt to be endearing. People don't argue seriously about what is trivial and of little concern to them. It's those things that we are firmly engaged with that are at the basis of quarrels and disputes. But this only leads to another question. Where is the origin of finding things endearing? The answer. Things which are endearing in the world have desire as their origin. The things that we find endearing, that we are firmly engaged with, are those things which are desirable. But why do we find some things desirable and other things not so desirable? What is the source of desire in the world? The answer. Desire arises in dependence upon what is called pleasant and unpleasant. The things that we find desirable are the things that produce pleasant feelings, and those things we find undesirable are ones that produce unpleasant feelings. The pleasant and unpleasant can be physical experiences, but most often they are mental experiences. But where do these experiences of pleasant and unpleasant come from? Where do the pleasant and the unpleasant have their origin? The answer, the pleasant and the unpleasant have their source in sense contact. We only judge something as pleasant or unpleasant if we experience it through our senses. Remember, for the Buddha, the mind is taught as the sixth sense, so thinking, remembering, feeling may all be mental, but they are also counted as sense contact. Where does sense contact have its origin in the world? The answer? Sense contacts are dependent upon name and form. Name and form is the literal translation of nama rupa. It's often translated in the context of dependent origination as mind and body or mentality materiality. But perhaps a better translation which can bring out more of what the Buddha was actually teaching would be concept and manifestation. Concept would be your idea of what you are experiencing. Manifestation would correspond to your actual sensory input. In other suttas, the Buddha explains sense contact as the coming together of three things, a sense object, a sense organ, and sense consciousness. The object and organ would be part of form materiality, at least for the five external senses, and sense consciousness would be the most basic mental processing of the sensory input, the basic knowing. There's more to this quarrels and disputes sutta, but what we have discussed so far gives us a new chart of dependent origination that immediately makes a lot more sense and is easier to understand than the 12-link chart at the top of this chapter. Quarrels and disputes arise dependent upon endearing, which arises dependent upon desirable, which arises dependent upon pleasant and unpleasant, which arise dependent upon sense contact, which arises dependent upon name and form. What we now have is the following, dependent upon name and form, especially if we think of them as mind and body. Sense contacts occur. These sense contacts are sometimes pleasant and sometimes unpleasant. We have a strong tendency to desire the pleasant and desire the absence of the unpleasant. If we obtain our desire, we find that endearing. Then we get engaged in quarrels and disputes if what we find endearing is threatened. This is very reminiscent of the second noble truth. Dukkha arises dependent upon craving, though here we find a synonym for craving, desire. We now have a bigger picture of the larger mechanism of the craving-desire-dukkha linkage. This is certainly much easier to get our heads around than the mysterious old rune of the 12-link version of dependent origination. But you might be thinking, well, this doesn't really look all that much like the 12-link dependent origination list at the start of the chapter. Indeed, sense contact and name and form are in both lists, but that's all that obviously matches. So let's rewrite the list from the beginning of the chapter, but in the reverse order. Aging and death arise dependent upon birth, arises dependent upon becoming, arises dependent upon clinging, arises dependent upon craving, arises dependent upon vedana, arises dependent upon sense contact, arises dependent upon six senses, arise dependent upon name and form, arise dependent upon consciousness, arises dependent upon sankhara, arise dependent upon ignorance. The first item in the list, aging and death, is often actually given as birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. This is a list of dukkha, just like quarrels and disputes are dukkha. Thus, we can actually change the first item in both of these lists to be dukkha in order for both to be more encompassing. At least we can if we show that the dependencies still apply. For the 12-link list, obviously one needs to be born if one is going to experience dukkha. For the Suttanipata 4.11 list, we have the second noble truth. Dukkha arises dependent on craving. But wait, the Suttanipata 4.11 list doesn't contain craving, but it does contain desire, and craving and desire are sometimes used interchangeably in the suttas. While we are noticing similarities, we can also notice that we cling to that which we find endearing. Plus, vedana is almost identical to pleasant and unpleasant. We desire and crave the pleasant, and we desire and crave for the absence of the unpleasant. An alternate listing is dukkha arises dependent upon endearing, arises dependent upon desirable, arises dependent upon pleasant and unpleasant, arising dependent upon sense contact, arising dependent upon name and form. So there is a subset of the 12 link list that closely matches the Suttanipata 4.11 list. But how come many of the words are different? And how did all those other six links get there? To answer these two questions, we should look at a paper by Joanna Jurevich entitled Playing with Fire, the Pratyasamutpada from the Perspective of Vedic Thought. Although I disagree with many of her assumptions about what the Buddha meant or was trying to do, the paper gives an excellent overview of the Vedic understanding of creation. This understanding, as presented by Jurevich, exactly matches the 12-link model, since her thesis is to make this match happen. But it's quite possible that the Buddha, or later disciples, took the words from Suttanipata 4.11 and made adjustments to those words so they match the subset of words from the Vedic understanding of creation, only the words, not the Vedic teaching. Then, over time, the other words from the Vedic understanding of creation crept in. Of course, this is just speculation. All we really know is that dependent origination evolved from the right-hand list above into the elaborated left-hand list above. We know for sure that the lists representing dependent origination are many and varied in the suttas. You can see Appendix 1 for a chart of some of the various recensions of the lists of dependent origination found in the suttas. There is more to this sutta than the things I have presented here. If you want to explore this sutta further, I have collected multiple translations plus the Pali and placed them in a table side by side on my website so that you can dive in more deeply. LeighB.com. If you do study this sutta in more detail, one thing to notice is that the questions are just too good. For example, the first full question is, where do quarrels and disputes originate and the sorrow, the grief, the selfishness, the pride, arrogance, and slander that go with them? Where do these originate? Come tell me. The origins of all of these bits of dukkha have a single, clear, compact answer. This is not likely a record of an actual conversation. When a question is asked, the answer is a concise, contained teaching that contains all the different aspects of the question. Whoever is asking the question seems to always ask them in such a way so there is a simple, compact answer. I'm guessing the Buddha composed this sutta as a result of the intuitive understanding that he attained the night of his awakening, as an attempt to describe what's going on and where he got it from. As was said above, there is more to Suttanipata 4.11 after name and form. We will address this near the end of the book, after we have more background in the depths of what the Buddha was actually teaching. The key takeaways from this chapter are that dependent origination isn't about cause. Dependent origination is about necessary conditions, and this sequence. Dukkha arises dependent upon endearing, which arises dependent upon desirable, which arises dependent upon pleasant and unpleasant, which arises dependent upon sense contact, which arises dependent upon name and form. Or, equivalently, dukkha arises dependent upon clinging, arises dependent upon craving, arises dependent upon vedana, arises dependent upon sense contact, arises dependent upon name and form. This provides a roadmap of how to escape dukkha. Name and form is a given, and because of that, we are going to have sense contacts. These sense contacts will inevitably generate vedana, since sense contacts are a sufficient condition for vedana. Then, if we are not careful, we will fall into craving and clinging, or equivalently desire and endearment. And that's a setup for dukkha. It's the care needed upon the arising of vedana that the Buddha teaches as the second establishment of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Suttas. This breaking the chain of dependent origination between vedana and craving is also a key point. The links prior to and including vedana are not under our control. Dependent on name and form, sense contacts arise, and these inevitably generate vedana. But if we can get our mindfulness in there with the vedana experience, we can stop right there before we get lost in any craving or clinging. The strategy for any sense contact is to enjoy the pleasant, deal with the unpleasant as necessary, and don't get caught in craving or clinging. This is why the links of dependent origination are so important. They provide the basic roadmap for overcoming dukkha. But these links, whether there are 2 or 6 or 12 or even more, are part of multiple teachings of dependent origination found in Buddhism. We will look at some of the more elaborate teachings and interpretations in the next few chapters.